Well, brethren, we've come to the last lesson for the Allentown Convention 1992, and we're very pleased to have Bob and Becky Gray with us this weekend, and Brother Bob has had many wonderful lessons. I've particularly appreciated him in the past half hour when he's reminded me of that horn of plenty with much coming out, and he's not quite sure, even though he's bursting with things to want to share with us, exactly what to share. And so for that reason, I'm looking forward to what I'm sure the Lord will overrule and guide and direct to be a wonderful lesson. But I don't have the title, so I'm going to leave it to Brother Bob.
Thank you, Brother David. That was a mercifully nice way of putting my indecision. You have love from our brethren at New Brunswick, those who could not be here. It's on our heart to want to speak to you about many different things today, and unfortunately they're all going to be at the same time, but they're different. The chalkboard is set up here in case I decided one way. That's how last minute the decision has been made. I think, though, that seeing what we've seen this week, weekend, and hearing what we've heard, and coming through the last hour with some very fine details of solid truth for us and some proofs which we need at this end of the age to confirm us again against the gainsayers, I think it would probably be appropriate for us to consider a text from Hebrews chapter 12. But Hebrews chapter 12 is part of a series of ideas and thoughts which are presented by an apostle who deeply loved those he wrote to, the Hebrews. He loved them so much that in the 9th chapter of the book of Hebrews, he was able to say that if it were possible, he would be accursed of Jesus if his brethren, according to the flesh, could appreciate Jesus. I don't know too many brethren who are prepared to make such a statement, that they would be willing to be put aside for others. Through the book of Hebrews, the apostle struggles with his Jewish brethren, trying to bring them to an appreciation of their new relationship to God through Jesus, a relationship which is more superior than angels will have, is more superior than the house of Moses, the Levitical priesthood. But he gets to a point where he finally says to them in the 5th chapter, "You're so dull of hearing." And nevertheless, he goes on and he pursues the matters regarding the typical tabernacle and the priesthood. When we get to chapter 11, the faith chapter, we're introduced to the heroes of faith. And when we get to chapter 12, we're reminded of those heroes of faith. It's interesting also that the Apostle Paul, in his writing, fully eight times, makes references to public races, activities of sport that were occurring in his day. What we would call the Olympics tested trials of strength and skill. Events such as foot races, wrestling, leaping, throwing, horses and chariot racing. Perhaps the simplest and the easiest to discuss is the foot race. There were various victories that were occurring at these races in different stages of victory. But the victor always received a crown, an olive wreath or an apple garland or perhaps pine or even parsley. Of course, the winner also got 500 drachmas, which wasn't bad either, but it only amounted to what we'd call about $87.50. Now compare that vegetable crown with that immortal crown of life, which our Father has offered as a prize to the victors in the Christian race course. The comparison of the literal race to the Christian race is a very powerful comparison, and it has survived centuries. It has survived translation. You are there already, I presume. Hebrews chapter 12. Let's read together verse 1. Wherefore, seeing we are also compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race set that is set before us. Every big race has its spectators. They give a sense of spirit to the runners. They signify the importance of the race to the runners. And here our spectators, or our witnesses, are the ancient worthies that we just spoke of, listed in chapter 11, the heroes of faith, who, before us, laid down their lives as a testimony to the truth. And they're witnesses in two ways. First, the word witness is derived from a word that is the idea martyr. And they were literally martyrs or witnesses to God's will and to God's character during their own lifetime. Second, they figuratively were witnesses to our race. They were rooting for the saints throughout the age. How could we say they were rooting? They looked in their minds to the time of the Christ. They saw the city. They were like Abraham, who saw Jesus' day. They were like Moses, who considered the reproaches of Christ greater riches than the treasure of Egypt. They rooted for that day. In the second sense, we also have the scripture in Isaiah, "And thine ears shall hear a word behind thee, saying, This is the way." In the February 1st Manna text, Brother Russell says, "In our own experiences, we should turn at once to the word of the Lord, to ponder its precepts and principles, its illustrations bearing upon perplexing subjects." The ancient worthies were living illustrations. And the more familiar we are with them, the more easily we can bring them into our life on a daily basis. I think you've experienced, as I have, watching someone behave in a certain way and finding it perhaps reproachable, wrong, difficult to deal with because you can't say something, but nevertheless, right in front of your eyes, a lesson. And then if you think very closely and carefully about it, you might even find that that lesson was not just a lesson or an example of poor behavior, but it might have actually been a parable describing to you personally, as it has to me, something that we have been doing that needs reproof. So what we can see in someone else's behavior was really allowed to be seen by us as a reproof. But likewise, experiences, and in our mind, as we are familiar with them, the lives of the ancient worthies were living illustrations of the same thing. And as I said, they are like a cheering squad, this great cloud of witnesses. Now, we know that in our studies, we've studied about the ancient worthies as pictured by the red heifer. And it was unusually treated, and we're not going to spend time looking into the red heifer type. But the processing of the red heifer provided for purifying. And that's what we would like to draw from that lesson. Because it is by seeing the lives of these individuals and letting ourselves enter into them and be chastened by them, we will learn how to take a step that would be in a different direction than we might have taken if we ignore those lessons. I don't know how many of you have one of those Bibles that you can read through in 1 year, but I chose this year to try to follow it through, and I'm somewhere about 4 days behind right now. But because I was reading those texts, so many of the lessons that I have read in scattered arrangements started falling into a sequence this year. That's been very helpful. But let's remember, they're not always good examples for our behavior. For example, you might remember the prophet that the Lord sent up from Judah to Bethel to prophesy against what Jeroboam was doing. Jeroboam, you know, dragged Israel down. The Lord said to Jeroboam, you're going to have the 10-tribe kingdom. He told him through a prophet, you're going to have the 10-tribe kingdom. And what did Jeroboam do? He became selfish. He says, we're going to have a new sacrifice. And he sets up these sacrifices at Bethel and in Dan. And he has the people worshiping there instead of in Jerusalem, because he was afraid the people would rise up and kill him and go worship and follow the people of Judah again. But that was the wrong turn. So the Lord sends this prophet up, and he goes all the way up to this place, and he has great brazenness. He goes right up to this altar, and he prophesies against Jeroboam and against the altar, and it's a great condemnation. And Jeroboam says, seize that man! And his hand turns leprous and withered. And everybody's astonished. And Jeroboam says, please do something. Appeal to God on my behalf. And he does. And Jeroboam's hands are okay. And he says, I'll come to my house now and have something to eat. You're such a wonderful prophet. By the way, the prophecy also came true. The altar split in half. All sorts of things happened at that moment, and it seemed that this prophet was really a prophet. Amazing. But he goes ahead and he betrays something the Lord told him to do. He said, don't stop, don't eat anywhere, and go back a different way, as if to do all things secretly. He announces this. Another prophet hears about this, saddles up a donkey and follows him, meets him and catches up with him sitting under a tree. What was he sitting under a tree for? He was supposed to go straight home. He must have been thinking about what a great job he did. You know, like when a speaker speaks, he gets off the platform and says, ah, that was a very good discourse I gave. But you must understand, that's exactly what happens in the human heart. And I think that's what happened to this prophet. And as he was sitting, thinking about what a marvelous thing it was, that the altar split in half and all kinds of things happened, and the withered hand, and it healed it again, he must have been enthralled with what he did. And he gets caught up to by this prophet who says to him, I am a prophet also. Come to my house. And he says, I can't. I have to go home. And he says, no. The Lord told me to bring you back and to have some food with you. And then the scripture says in parentheses, he was lying. So this other man believes him because he wants to believe what? A lie. The Lord told him personally, go there and come back a different way. And now he wants to believe a lie. Brethren, in the race for our life, which is the title of this discourse, by the way, the race for our life, we must not turn aside. And we must not obey a lie. We must not listen to voices that are discordant and not what the words we have heard. And in the illustrations that we're going to be looking at of the runner, we must remember also that this prophet who did go back and did have something to eat, and then the Lord really told this lying prophet the truth, and he told him to tell this other prophet what? That he would not be buried in the tomb of his fathers. And this prophet leaves and he goes down the road and a lion slays him, but doesn't eat him, and doesn't hurt the donkey, and just stands there and waits for something. And sure enough, the message comes back to this prophet who lied, and he realizes what happened, and he goes and he gets the man, and there's the lion standing there with the donkey and the dead man. That's judgment. Retributive judgment? It's judgment. The point being that we don't want to step aside from our course, believe a lie, and fall aside from what is true, fall aside from what is right, and fall aside from what is holy. We'll have another point to bring back to refer to this again, but we'd like to just remember that not everybody written about in the Old Testament Hebrew accounts and ancient worthies is a sterling example. This man is an example of what not to do. What not to do. The ashes of the red heifer were remembrances. We know that when we see ashes, what is left of what was once, burned and left there, we know that those ashes represent what existed. And likewise with the ashes of the red heifer, the memories that we need to have in our mind of these ancient ones. And then, by the way, not just the ancient worthies, but all the saints of old. Jesus, the apostles, and other saints. How to do this? Selecting a different person than the one we just told you about, read that life, read it over, read it from several translations, meditate on it, and give yourself time to identify with the personality, the struggles, the deprivations, their braveries, their weaknesses, their faith. Look up their name in the topical index. Follow them through what Brother Russell had to say about them. Follow through the logic that he follows in their life. And from the testimony of their lives, that in spite of the frustrations of Moses and the loneliness of David, the weakness of Samson, and the hesitation of Barak, they all had faith to finally overcome. And that's the faith we need. That's why they're mentioned to us, seeing we have such a great cloud of witnesses. We must lean on these faith examples to bolster our faith in times of weakness, loneliness, hesitation, and even frustration. And what should make us run harder? What are they offered? Life. What is the church offered? Immortal life? To be a part of the bride of Christ? To be a part of that family which will see God? Think more soberly. I know you think soberly. Think more soberly yet about such a weight of difference. They endured much, the ancient worthies. And their reward is less. In fact, it will be your privilege, and mine, I hope, to be able to bless them to get their reward. And then, if you can, when you think of this text, think of them as if it were that you were running a literal race, and they were in the stands, literally cheering you on by their life, by their example. Now, we're encouraged to lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset. Weights and sin. Let's talk about weights. It is extremely difficult to run an intense race. And those who are among the elite runners, especially in the days of Apostle Paul, they ran without any clothes to hold them back. And in modern time, the clothing is so thin and so expensive, actually, so thin that they virtually have no weight to restrain them. What are our weights? I think every one of us knows what weight we might have on our shoulders or around our neck or wherever. But some of the weights could be the deceitfulness of riches, the pleasures of worldly ambition, the pride of life, the good, the wholesome, the everyday things of life which are there for us. And in our day, they are forced up into our visual and mental vision so strongly by the advertising media that we really don't have a chance to run away from them. And if that doesn't hurt, others are making comparisons. Our worldly friends are constantly making comparisons. If we go to lunch with somebody at work, they're making references to the temporal, the material, the good life, the things that they think they want to have. And these are the things that are constantly put before us. Where it becomes a problem to us is when we bring the same spirit into our fellowship with saints. And we do. It's inevitable that we'll talk about temporal things with the brethren. So if it's inevitable, let's keep it to a forced minimum. And let's try to spend whatever time we can on the more spiritually profitable discussions in such simple places as our meeting halls, lunch tables, fellowship whenever we can be together. Because the tendency is that these temporal things will dominate. After all, we spend a great deal of time both wearing temporal things, thinking about what we're going to wear the next day and the next day, and maybe what we have to prepare for work for the next day. A lot of temporal things, cars, all kinds of problems. And they differ for each one of us. Because to me, a weight today, tomorrow might not be a weight. But what is no weight to you today could become a burden to you tomorrow. And it could weigh you down and it could cost you. Brother Russell's counsel on this: a man who enters the race with a wife and children must not throw these aside. If he has a child on each shoulder, he then must run with them. If one who is unmarried is thinking of engaging in this race, he will do well to consider how many children he should have on each shoulder, or whether he should have a wife on his shoulders. Some would be hindered with a wife, while others might be hindered without a wife. Each must decide for himself what's best. Reprint 53:19. Then there's another kind of weight, the weight of sin. Sometimes a runner is expected to run even with an injury. I don't mean a crippling or damaging injury, but an injury, something that is a muscle pull or something of that nature. Brethren, there is not a one of us who is running without an injury. We have, every one of us, some kind of weakness or pain or something that is weighing us down, some kind of malady, some kind of handicap, every single one of us. With some, these seem insurmountable at times, and weren't for the grace of God, we would say it is insurmountable. But the sin which doth so easily beset us, and we could say this perhaps is Adamic sin, which just comes down on us as a weight all the time. Or it might be some particular, personal, close-girding sin that besets us till the end of our course. For some one, it might be touchiness. Another one, it might be anxiety, worry. Some might be both. Some it might be a need to control, such as the control that individuals like to have over others, that drive them to desiring to be in power. And yet for other, it might be indecision, like trying to figure out what discourse to give. Some are affected even by such things as drinking. Some are tempted by it. But some are tempted by other things which would parallel drinking. Because while the alcoholic might be addicted to one substance, others of us might be addicted to other things. And they might be a variety. They might be some kind of medication, some kind of drug. Some of us might be tempted to do other things. You know, the scriptures warn us against fornication and against adultery. There is a reason for these being mentioned. It means that there's going to be temptations coming in front of your eyes, in your mind, in my mind, on all of these different levels. If it were not so, it would not be written. And I don't think there's anyone in this room would say it's not true. It's true. So we have to lay aside all the weights that are going to drag us down and let such things as these temptations, of even such things as adultery and fornication and drugs and drinking and the other matters in terms of maligning individuals, you might call that murder, whatever. Let's take one example. This world is set a standards for itself, hasn't it? I mean, they have new rules to go by. If you turn on a television, you know what you're going to see on television these days besides the terrible news. You're going to see whatever the world thinks they want to talk about. Well, do you really want to listen to that and watch that? Yeah, sometimes you do. Oh, it's harmless, isn't it? It's harmless, isn't it? Isn't it? Well, maybe not. Maybe those stories that are just funny are really planting an idea, if not in your mind, in the mind of a young child that's with you, that really fornication's okay, after all. You know, it's just fun. It's nice. I mean, how much are we going to allow come into our home? So therefore, we say to ourselves, well, I can't watch this program. Well, I'll watch another one. Well, in that one, it's adultery. And in another one, it's drinking. And in another one, it's something else. And it's all okay. And the world really has, in the last 25 or 30 years, decided it's okay to put this on the tube. Actually, 20 years ago, it was doing it a little bit more subtly. But it was there. So the mind begins to think, well, I know that, brethren, you're not going to all of a sudden watch a television program and be tempted. No, you're not, and I'm not either. But what it's doing is it's planting seeds of thought that these are okay things, that it's proper, there's nothing wrong with it. And if we begin to allow thoughts to enter our minds that are not true, we begin to clutter our mind with matter that is very negative. Anyway, it's not spiritually profitable for us to be thinking about such things anyway, and the levity level is awful. Do you not know that those who run or who race in the stadium all run, to be sure, but one receives the prize. So run your race that you may win. Have you ever watched somebody running who didn't intend to win? People run races figuring they can't possibly win, and they usually fulfill that prophecy, unless everybody just falls down. And everyone who enters the contest practices self-control in every detail. He indeed does it to receive a perishable crown. We're reading from the New Berkeley from 1 Corinthians. Indeed, he does it to receive a perishable crown, but we an imperishable. Accordingly, I run straight ahead, not aimlessly. I thus box, not punching the air, but discipline my body and make it serve me so that I myself may not be disqualified. Now, scholars tell us that the Isthmian Games near Corinth were a passion among these people. This was not just amusement and casual passing of time. These people were dead earnest about these games. And so the apostle was using an illustration of the dead earnestness which we must have. When we say the race for your life, this is not just the race of your life. This is the race for your life. You are running for your life. Of course, you're not competing against the brother or sister in front of you, behind you, or on the other side of you. You're racing against yourself. The new creature is trying to beat the old nature, the old flesh, the old fleshly mind, the old-willed, mixed-up mind. It's trying to beat it. It's got to win. So the race for our life must do this disciplining that's referred to in 1 Corinthians 9, 24 to 27, which we just read. Now, scholars tell us that the games were in dead earnest. So let's look at the details. In 1 Corinthians 9, verse 24, even in the Christian race, brethren, all who enter do not win the race. Many are called, but few are chosen. In verse 25, self-control is very essential for the athlete and for the Christian. The athlete strictly watches his diet, or at least he should, to enhance his performance. He abstains from wine and pleasant foods. And likewise, the Christian is to abstain from this world's delicacies. Do we say no to the unnecessary luxuries that will take up our time and our affections? Verse 26, we have a definite goal, the finish line of crystallized, perfect love. And to get there, literally, we might say the athlete beats or boxes the air. Now, there's a need for the athlete to build up, the runner, to build up not just the leg muscles, but also the upper body. The body must be in balance. In order for an athlete to throw his body forward into such a pitch of fervor to go forward, they must have the strength in the upper body to counterbalance all the motions below. And believe it or not, strength in the upper body is essential to essentially pull you along. But one doesn't use their hands and flail them about either in running. One keeps them somewhat low, lest you waste a lot of energy. So you're not going to do this for futile reasons. And we do have a real race on our hands. And we need to build ourselves up for this race. You might want to look in your time, 5778 reprint, dealing with our race. And then verse 27, the purpose of keeping our body under is for what? To serve the new creature. Now, in Corinth, there were those ascetics, you know, people who put their body physically under, neglecting their body to some extent, punishing them for a while. But some of these self-denials, which would be exampled by such ascetics, should be the kind of self-denials that would purposefully benefit the new creature. In other words, we have to put aside those things in our life which would be the distractions to the new creature, but which would tend to make the flesh very pleased. The satisfying of fleshly lusts or indulging in anything for the flesh or for the human nature is counterproductive and costly to the new creature. And Apostle Paul tells us this because he says, when I have preached, lest when I have preached to others, or as the literal meaning is, heralded to others, the person loses the race because they have failed in these other areas. You know, when a person heralds a race, they're the ones who herald and call the individuals to come forward. They must be careful what they're saying. I observed a situation once where a herald, you might say, in that sense, of a race, falsely and incorrectly called the runners to the field. The correction was made, but not all the runners noticed the correction had been made, and some of them ran in the wrong race. Now, this is a suggestion to us. If we are going to participate and literally tell the word to others, it should be a pure, clear, trumpeted message, a word of truth that is pure. And I think Brother Rick's references yesterday to this idea of mixing and involving ourselves with the ideas, the teachings, the associations of the nominal system can be very, very damaging. And I think we must, if at all possible, direct our brethren to the writings of the harvest message and not to misguide them by referring them to writings of those who are not the writers in the harvest message spirit and truth. There's a lot to read in the 6,000 pages of the reprints and the hundreds and hundreds of pages of the volumes and so forth with the Tabernacle Shadows, the convention reports. Enough to keep us filled for a part of a lifetime. And for us to have not read topically parts of the reprints, where the harvest message begins, and actually where the volumes are even included, is to say that we haven't really taken the opportunity to find out what message are there for us on the levels of Christian living. We're not just talking doctrine. We're not just talking prophecy. We're talking Christian living, character development. These are thoughts which are planted there for us by the pastor and by the providence, I believe, of the Lord. And I think we could do well to study deeper into them and to share those with our brethren if we are elders. Lest after we preach the truth to others, let us not be quitters. Let us not fall apart. Let us not give in to discouragement ourselves. Let us not be self-serving with distractions of this world and wind up, so to speak, a castaway, disqualified, because the rules were not followed. You know, Ben Johnson, a very famous athlete you probably have heard of, and if you didn't, I'll tell you briefly. He ran in the 88 Olympics. He set a world record. He was disqualified for being on steroids. You say, no matter, he ran the race. He won. No, he was disqualified. He broke the rules. Imagine how he felt when he was told, your world's record has been expunged, erased, gone. He had lived outside the rules and become a castaway. We need to know the rules of our lives, and we need to follow them. Back to Hebrews 12, verse 1. With patience denotes a cheerful endurance, not by fits and starts, but by constancy. For every day or week we may not have the same measure of zeal, but there should be a certain underlying steadiness. We are talking about being consistent, a consistent runner, running a pattern. Many suggest to runners to run a certain way. And some coaches say, no, you learn this pattern and it will serve you well. Because as you learn this pattern and you get stronger, you will go through the race successfully. And there is no other way this race can be run successfully than the way I am telling you as your coach. Oh, you can do it this way, and it might gain you a half second here and a half second there. But this is the way that you get to the end of the race, and you can get there the fastest once you build up your strength. And a good coach will advise a runner how to pace himself, judging that runner's ability. The elite runner will usually have a very close relationship with such a coach. Usually that coach has excelled in that particular sport themselves, and they know what can be done and what cannot be done. And they'll set distances for the individual to run. I want you to run so fast by such and such a time, and a little further by the next time. And a good coach will not come down too hard on his athlete for not having a good day. He will let him get discouraged, but he'll encourage him by making suggestions and teaching him how to learn from his mistakes. He will give him constructive ideas for improving his race. And athletes like to please their coach. They will try to do this. A wise coach will put that athlete through grueling workouts, which the athlete might not comprehend. Why are we working so hard? But later the athlete will realize, when running the race, that these experiences of practices were building up endurance. And the next time his body is screaming, he will say, the coach knows best. A true coach will know when you are doing your best. He'll even see that sometimes the teammates are very encouraging to the athlete, but the coach will not be encouraging. He'll seem unimpressed. But later, after a time, he'll settle down and he'll tell the runner what is good and what is bad. And the coach does know what's best. And the strong coach will teach his runner to keep his mind clear. Distractions are costly. I've seen runners false start because of a slight distraction, costing them a title when they could have easily won it. We need to put aside the distractions and remember the words, "This one thing I do." But the merciful coach knows his athlete's limits. Everyone in running seeks a personal best time. Whether they're a winner or a third or fourth, they seek a personal best, which means they're always trying to accomplish their personal best. And that's what we will find ourselves seeking, our personal best, because we cannot always be compared with other runners. We have to be compared with what the Lord expects of us. There are the 10 talented, the 5 talented, the 2 talented. And brethren, what we need to do is recognize the Lord wants us to stretch those talents. Whether we have 1 or 2 talents in our possession, if we do not let the Lord stretch those talents, we're burying them. You may have the ability to take Brother X to the meeting, but when it comes to taking Brother X and Brother Y, you know, you're tired. But the Lord knows you can do it, so He stretches that talent. He makes you do the 2. And you find out you can do the 2. And you can grow with that. And that's the way it is in other levels of our experience. Think how many times brethren may have commended you on your service to the Lord. Now, that can have several results. You can say, for example, "It's about time somebody noticed." And I don't think any of us want to say that. Or you could say, "Thank you for the encouragement." And really mean that was encouraging. Because we do need encouragement. We don't need pride. Or you could say, "This is a heavy responsibility. Because I really must live up to this. I must continue in this. I must work diligently at this and take even more seriously the responsibility of that service which was noticeable." The Lord Jesus knows how much effort we've been putting into the race. And sometimes we probably feel guilty about being complimented because we don't think we put in very much effort anyway. But remember, anything and everything the brethren can say to us, including raising their hands for us as a servant of the ecclesia in some way, is not the bottom line of who we are in the scheme of things. It is a part of it. It is not the bottom line. The bottom line is what the Lord sees. The bottom line is the Lord's evaluation of us at the end of our course and through our course. Jesus, of course, brethren, is our coach, wiser than any earthly coach could ever be. He is always there for us. He always knows what it's like. He was in the race himself. He knows the self-denial. He knows the hardship. He knows the pain. He knew his pain. He knows your pain. In Jesus' supervision of our day, he paces us. He expects us to reach certain short-range goals. He knows we are ready for certain goals, and he'll give us experiences for that. He knows what is best, but he is patient. He will not yell at us for our failures, but he will chide us lovingly. He will help us to understand how we can do better the next time. Sometimes we'll not understand why so much has happened to us all at once. And sometimes it hasn't, but we feel that way. And maybe it doesn't make any difference then, because we're under this burden and we need to know what is happening. Has there been some mistake? You know, why is this happening to me? There must be a mistake. You know that there's a writer who came out of Russia several years ago, and he describes in his first chapter of his book, Gulag Archipelago. It was written by Solzhenitsyn. He says, when they come and knock in the middle of the night at 3 o'clock in the morning at your door and say, Mr. Stein or Mr. Luke or Mr. Grice, we want to speak with you. Yes, open the door. You're under arrest. Solzhenitsyn says, the only thing is, this is a mistake. I have done nothing wrong. This is a mistake. It couldn't be me. You must mean somebody else. You have the wrong street, the wrong address. And they don't give you any time. They want to hurry you out. And it's a desperate feeling. That's the kind of feeling I think we have when we're having trials. Why now? You know, the why me question. It happens. I mean, I don't think you say that every time you have a trial, but it happens. And I don't think we should think this without reflecting also that we have made a commitment to the Lord which allows all manner of experiences. And anyway, by the way, the world's having these experiences anyway. You should recognize, and I should recognize when this happens, that the Lord is dealing with us. And while the world and we are going through the same terrible experience at the same time, we have a linkage with a Father in heaven who is hand-shaping our experiences and allowing these to happen. But afterwards, when we see the reason why Jesus has lovingly overruled these experiences, we can come to some rest. And when this happens, we have less repining and more trust. Our forerunner Jesus knows better than we what can be expected of us, and he knows our limitations, our strengths, and our weaknesses. He can be trusted. He can be trusted. And he was a runner too, and he won his race. And you know that, and not to forget. So who, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. The prospect of the finish is what enables the runner, the awesome runner, to endure the rigors of the race. A runner may have ability, but may not be, as they say, be psyched for the race. He must concentrate and focus. And Jesus, for the joy that was set before him, the joy that gave him strength, focus, helped him endure, overcome the most extenuating circumstances, was able to finish his race. But what was it? What was the joy? In his heart and mind, he had the joy of doing his Father's will. He had the joy of knowing he would be redeeming and restoring mankind. He had the joy of bringing many sons to glory with him, and the joy of exaltation to glory, honor, and immortality, to be again with his Father. Have we made every conscious effort to think about Jesus? The scripture that says, "For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners," begins with the three words, "For consider him." I know that I need to consider Jesus more every day. And it's not going to be just a word on a wall that says Jesus that makes me do that. I believe I need to be reading words that he spoke and thinking thoughts that he thought, and then he will be on my mind in a way that is going to be meaningful to me. Now, maybe words on the wall, and we have a lot of plaques up reminding us in different places about this. A sister told me, the walls in your house talk. And what does that mean? Well, they're up there. If you stop and look, they're talking to you. There's little quotations. They're wonderful helps. But we have to input from the scriptures and from the harvest message the substance which we can meditate on. If there's nothing in there to meditate on, you can't meditate. Nothing's going to happen. It's going to be like an empty barrel. I don't think you're empty barrels. I hope I'm not. But we have to be feeding ourselves so that we can have something to think about. If you have a question, write it down, and the next time you're with the brethren, ask the question. Ask the question. A good spiritual question, good scriptural question, is better to introduce in a conversation than no question. An idle time that could have been spent building one another up with just thoughts that are wholesome for the new mind to be thinking about, and encouraging thoughts. Jesus did not experience the personal besetting sins which we endure, but he did experience the contradiction of sinners in and around him. The scribes and Pharisees were always at his shirt tail, so to speak, trying to trip him up from the sidelines and snare him in some way, embarrass him in front of the throngs of people. With Jesus' ability, the temptation was not so much knowing what to say. The temptation was knowing how hard he should come back at these people. And he didn't come back in a mean and, rendering evil for evil manner. He came back at them with questions and answers and comments that put them in their place nicely, relatively speaking. But he could have destroyed them with his words. He could have put them to shame in such a way that would have more than embarrassed them. It would have been improper spirit, but he was able with good sound teachings to put them in their place. Now, there were times when he was more severe than others, we understand, but he could have been much more caustic. That was not his spirit. We need to remember that when we are talking about this contradiction of sinners, lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds, there is another response here. While Jesus was surrounded by sin, he did not give in to it. We, unfortunately, will fall into sin. And that's why we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. And so, therefore, we may be limping, we may want to collapse into sin, but we don't have any choice. We should resist. We should prevent ourselves from letting ourselves slide down, collapse into sin. You know the scripture, you have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. First time I read that to my conscious memory was when a young sister, I mean that I have really thought about it, was when a young sister made one of those sticker things and put it on my wife's Bible. I saw it there for months and months, and it was just a constant reminder. You have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. I think some of us will. I think some of us will. Many of our brethren have, and not only from 2,000 years ago. Many of our brethren have within this century. Many of our brethren have, even in recent years in Romania, experienced very, very great difficulties. And in other places as well. Poland as well. Russia, definitely. On the point of discouragement, I'd like to quote from Pastor Russell. A sober view of the situation on discouragement, fortifies our minds against discouragement. Such a sober view keeps reason on the throne of the mind. Reason says, the divine call to joint heirship implies eligibility. Divine promise clearly ensures divine grace to enable us to fulfill the conditions. That's like a guarantee clause. We have to believe that the eligibility implies it implies the ability that we would have to fulfill this. If we find we have been accepted in the race, That means we are able to be winners. We must believe that. We must hold on to that and not let it go. Now, there are factors that will be a part of our everyday decision making that are going to come into this race. What are we going to eat? What kind of a diet is there for us as runners? Well, what are you eating every day? What am I eating every day? Are they the words of truth? How are we exercising? How are we exercising our minds? What are we doing with our thoughts, our meditative time? If indeed this is a race for your life, then you and I have to take it more seriously each day, because each day makes us even more responsible. We'd like to summarize with the reading of Hebrews 12, 1 and 2 from the New Berkeley Translation. If we find that we have been accepted in the race, that means we're able to be winners. So then, encircled as we are, with such a great cloud of witnesses all about us, let us get rid of every impediment and the sin that ensnares us so easily, and let us run steadily the course mapped out for us. With our eyes on Jesus, the cause and completer of our faith, who in view of the joy that lay before him, submitted to the cross, though thought nothing of the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Compare your experience with him. Compare your experience with his, who was willing to stand so much hostility from sinners against himself, so that you may not become weary and despondent. Our race, brethren, is a race to the death. But our race to that finish will be rewarded with the crown of life. May the Lord add his blessing.